Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. There's no doubt that electronic devices have a dominant presence in our society. From computers to cell phones to television and beyond, we are spending more and more time staring at screens. The American Association of Pediatrics estimates that children average as much as 7 hours of screen time a day. While it can be argued that some of those 7 hours are productive, there's a downside. What's the impact on young lives, and what can parents do to ensure that the positive outweighs the negative? I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio to talk about it is Dr. Matt Broom, pediatrician at Slucare and Cardinal Glennon. Doctor, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
In a very general way, let me get your take on the issue of screen time for the young.
Yeah, it's an omnipresent issue for us, Don. It's something that we address at every well-child visit. It's something that we live with both personally and beyond, and it affects everything that we do because of how much of it is in not only our schools, but just the globalization of media and the endemic television use across the United States.
Give me some specifics about how you deal with it in these well visits.
Absolutely. So as you had mentioned, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that at every well visit we ask two questions. How many hours of screen time, so TV, movies, video games, phones, texting, etc., does your child do a day? And the goal is less than 2 hours. And then the other question that's always interesting as far as discussion-wise is, does your child have a television in their bedroom? Do they have internet connectivity in their bedroom? And that's really where you can kind of get into trouble just because of the health consequences.
You say 2 hours is the goal. I can hear young people out there laughing right now at the notion of 2 hours a day.
They really are. And you know, and the issue is that they see so much of it in school, and there's so many educational benefits of utilizing technology and screens. However, what we're looking at is television viewing, potential negative advertisements that come in within that. A TV show may be appropriate for children, but are the commercials? Even we see that now within the Olympics that we're watching.
Well, that's not new. I mean, parents have complained about that for a long time.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is looking at younger kids, you know, the more times that they are sitting with a screen and looking at that, one, they're sedentary, they're not as active, and they're just not doing creative thinking. They're not getting out and doing some of those things that we all need for our minds to develop and push themselves.
That is the big rap against it. It always comes up. It's always the first thing, that this is why young people are obese, is because they spend so much time sitting, staring at a screen.
Well, and you know, certainly that's something that's maintained not only by the Academy of Pediatrics, but the AHA. However, there is really good evidence that if you spend less than 2 hours a day doing screen time, you are indeed sedentary. You're more likely to do grazing. You're more likely to maybe have errors in your sleep or have disruptive sleep, potentially making poor diet choices as you're grazing through on those snacks. And subsequently, that leads down the line to being overweight or obese.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I do know that you have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, I believe. Give me some sense of what you're going through right now, because I know there is pressure even at those ages to get with it.
Absolutely. And they're not happy about it, right? They're in the same group that was like, get this guy off right now. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think they're in a tremendous school. They have a lot of great resources. You can find a lot of great ways to utilize electronic devices, be it either electronic books, educational games, interactive things. Although I think one of the things that's often missed with parents is that screens are not just e-babysitters, right? We can't put them down so we can run and take a shower or do all these other things. The reality is that we need to be interactive with our kids. What do you like about this show? What do you not like? What do you think about that? So we can actually see what they're viewing. And the other key is setting limits. So many families don't set limits, and if you don't do that, the expectation is really they can watch for you know, however long they like.
Isn't it true that in many cases the parents are the negative influence because they're doing the same thing?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, if you look at advertisements, all of our kids really want to emulate their parents, and they're going to watch and take that as the standard bearer for what they do. And I think it's also important that certainly there are good television programs and screen, you know, uses as far as for kids, but if adult programming is on and children's are secondhand in the room, they're still getting those messages sent to them. And if you don't, you know, approach those and talk appropriately with them, you know, something could be missed.
Has the American Pediatric Association in any way broken down those 7 hours in terms of how much of the seven could be considered educational, productive, and how much is just kind of time wasted?
You know, that's a great question. If you look at screen time in general, TV use has actually been fairly stable. So there haven't been a lot of increases or decreases as far as for television. However, obviously what's blown up over the last 10 years is social media, phone use, computer use, those kind of things. I think what we really need to look at is not only when are those things occurring, but what are the times at night? Did you set a limit of no screen time after X amount, you know, after 9 o'clock, after 9:30? Is it something where, all right, good night, sweetheart, you're going to bed, but then that child, because they have internet connectivity or a television, I mean, they're kids, of course they're going to turn it on. You and I probably would have done the same thing, but really setting those limits and following up with parents and families on that subsequently.
I think with us it was a transistor radio listening to the Cardinal game.
There you go.
At 10 o'clock at night. Looking back at the parents now, a lot of parents today, although not the younger ones, but a lot of parents today are at somewhat of a disadvantage in all of this because they're not as savvy when it comes to these devices as the kids are.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, in our waiting room and in my own home, I mean, my children can probably reformat a telephone, cell phone quicker than I can just looking at it because they've grown up as those millennial learners, you know, Generation Y, basically. And because of that, they're used to it. They're used to quick multitasking and changing. And that does put the rest of us at a disadvantage, but it doesn't mean we can't be educated and proactive about it.
Yeah. Well, how do we go about that? Let's start with the parents. How do we go about getting them in sync with their kids?
Well, I think with anything, when you talk about parents, you're going to need to figure out what their perception is first, right? You know, hey, what do you think would be an appropriate amount of viewing for your child on this? And if they're in the ballpark of, you know, 2 to 3 hours, well, that's great. But if they're already at 8 to 10, well, probably they're not going to get down to 2 in a 15 or 20 minute visit. You have to talk about, well, how does that affect things? And have you noticed these things? And also be able to look at it in the context of their own child. And it depends. Different things appeal to different families. I think one of the things we talked about was television advertising. What is it, $25 billion a year on tobacco and alcohol ads that are on television. And our children see those things, and they can still be affected by them.
And they can also find things on the internet that perhaps their parents couldn't even find.
Absolutely. Yep. You may have some type of internet-capable device, you know, let's say a Kindle Fire, an iPad, or an iPhone that someone's using. And, yeah, you know, you don't want your child to use YouTube. But what if they do? And what if they do a search for something and they can bring up illicit material, explicit material for that?
Sure. When did you and people like you begin to make an issue of this during these well visits? When did it really begin to perk?
You know, that's a great question. So really around the year 2000 and beyond, we started seeing more and more policy statements by the American Academy of Pediatrics. The section on media started putting out, hey, look at all of these kids that spent so much time, you know, in front of a screen, less than 2, versus those older than 2. And actually, you know, there's been a change where now the recommendation is for those children less than 2 to discourage screen time for them.
What is happening to the child under 2 who somehow is exposed to these various screens?
Well, and I think it's important to look at the context of their development. So less than 2 is a developing child that's much different than someone that's 2 to 4. So your language development is very early. You need to have contextual communication, interaction. You need to have creative thinking and learning. Whereas if you're in front of a screen, you may see a lot, but you're still not having that interaction and opportunity for creativity.
It's really remarkable the age at which you see youngsters today with cell phones.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, I mean you're getting a little pressure probably from both of yours, 6 and 9, but you see 6-year-olds with cell phones.
You do, and it's something that's amazing, right? 10 years ago, we would have laughed that off. And now, you know, I'll have, you know, my son who he just pushes the envelope. Hey, when am I getting my phone? And, you know, we laugh about it now of like, well, not soon. However, when is that time? And, you know, the biggest issue is children are used to that. Again, they see us. We have those cell phones. But if you look at it, I think we had talked a bit about it. So teenagers, they don't use their cell phones to talk, which is also disheartening. I mean, so other than senior citizens, they are the demographic that uses their cell phones for speaking, you know, the least. They use it for texting.
There is a lot of pressure on parents, too, because of something like the situation in southern Missouri just these last couple of days where a youngster is abducted and unfortunately murdered. So the parents think, my kid has to have a cell phone in case there's an emergency.
You know, it's a great example. I think that looking at it in the context of, you know, what does a child need a cell phone? When are they able to utilize it? What is the likelihood of something tragic like that occurring? And obviously that's an individual decision for families. But I think that you can, if a family brings that to you, you have to talk about potentially the risks with that too. These millennial kids are great multitaskers, but they're not very efficient with it. So as they get older, they may be texting, but they get distracted. They could walk out into a street. They could be texting while driving. All of this stuff kind of leads downstream for us.
And we talk about the downside when people are doing this when they're texting rather than having a face-to-face communication. Something gets lost there, too, in terms of simply socializing.
Absolutely. And stuff can get taken out of context, too. I mean, we see that with email and everything else. I mean, and yet at the same time, a lot of our children now and that generation that are growing up, that's what they see. It's a very quick, immediate level of communication. But we need to see those face-to-face interactions or hear the changes in voice to really learn some of those cues.
In terms of the devices themselves, is there a worse offender?
Well, I would say, text messaging and cellular phone use, because also you get into sexting and sending, explicit material back and forth. And then also social media. I mean, I think those are those arenas that particularly for parents that didn't grow up with those devices, those applications to get into, it's hard to know how to set the limits if you're not familiar with it yourself.
It's so important, as we are learning and have learned the last couple of years. Young people have a tendency at times to put things on their Facebook page, for instance, which could stay with them for the rest of their life and lives and affect employment and acceptance to colleges and universities and all the rest of it.
Absolutely. And we see that all the way downstream. It's interesting now in medical education. So medical students applying are adjusting their Facebook pages from earlier in their lives, secondary to what that impact may be for graduate medical education. And it's something that didn't exist 20 years ago. I mean, everyone probably has made mistakes at some point, but looking forward on how do you police that? How do you monitor it, especially at the teen level, is really hard.
Yeah, because they're out of sight and not out of mind, but out of sight so much you can't control that very well.
And I think that, again, setting expectations, setting rules, talking to kids about it and being forward with it. Sometimes I'll talk to families and ask a child, let's say who's 13, hey, do you have a Facebook site? And the parent would interject, no, they don't. And the child says, yes. And then obviously that leads into its own discussion. So
one of the things I think we have to be careful about in our conversation is to make the audience think that we think that all of this is bad. Some of it is, but there is an upside, too, as you've indicated earlier on, an upside to having access to devices like these.
Absolutely. Not only from an educational upside. I mean, with all of this that we're talking about, the reason some of these tools are in our school systems are because they can offer fantastic benefits for certain kids at different levels. And it can be great learning devices. And even texting, one of the benefits of 13 to 17-year-olds texting 3,000 times a month is they can be approached through their cell phone. So even in healthcare and healthcare communication, we're moving into researching those applications. We do that at SLU Care, and then people around the country are looking into that.
Sure. Well, we'll talk about the latest in that particular part of the arena in just a moment. My guest in studio is Dr. Matt Broom, pediatrician at SLU Care at Cardinal Glennon. And we'll want to get your input on this, too. I'm sure there are many parents out there and hopefully some young people, too, who would like to weigh in on the issue of screen time, how much time is good time to be spent staring at one of those screens or utilizing them somehow. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And, of course, we will take a tweet. We'll be back with Dr. Broom in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation about the amount of time that young people spend in front of the various screens that are available to them and all those electronic devices that, as the doctor put it, are omnipresent in our society today. That's Dr. Matt Broom, pediatrician at SLU Care, Cardinal Glennon. I wanted to mention the fact, as we did off the air, that Facebook is now involved in a new app that is a messaging app that they're spending $19 billion with a B to acquire this particular app. It just means that this is going to grow and grow and grow, doesn't it, Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, hearing that this morning, it is amazing. But look at that investment that they're doing, because this is the way that we're moving as far as for electronic communication and recognizing the importance. We're talking about a demographic that can be very difficult to reach, and yet we know they're utilizing texting. And I think, as we talked, that's currently more of a global app. However, looking at the United States and the high utilization of texting and smartphones among our youth, this is something that I'm sure will take off.
Is there a specific age at which this is a greater problem than another?
Well, I think that as children develop and go through puberty, I mean, obviously there's all that roller coaster of hormones going all over the place. But at the same time, the biggest issue is figuring out, how they interact socially, you know. And you had mentioned something as far as for bullying, and bullying either be it social media or texting. I mean, kids can be really mean. I would hate to go back to school right now. It can just be a tough time. And I think proactively talking about that with families, I mean, we had mentioned it maybe 9 and 10 to really start laying that groundwork before, you know, and that's specific to social media, before it can really hit into middle school and high school. It doesn't mean you can't talk about it with younger kids, but you want to try to address it as it becomes into their purview.
But as you had mentioned earlier, keep the 2 and under away from it because there is a developmental consequence.
Well, there can be. I mean, you don't want to limit. There's not good evidence, really, that programming, be it either Sesame Street or educational videos less than 2 has positive consequences for kids. Now, that being said, over 2, Sesame Street and some of those programs could be very developmentally appropriate for children. However, less than 2, when you're still developing a lot of those key language skills, we want to make sure that we emphasize more interaction, creativity, reciprocal speech as far as with parents.
Talk to the youngster. Don't give it something to play with doesn't interact with them. We have an email here from one of your colleagues, and I hope I have the pronunciation correct. It's Dr. Nadim Kanafani. Is that right?
Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
All right. He says, there is both a quantity and quality issue with children and screen time. I counsel patients that not all screen time activities are of equal quality. Specifically, I ask parents to limit commercial screen time, that is, screen time that exposes children to commercials and other marketing, to as little time as possible. I also strongly dissuade parents from allowing children to play violent first-person shooter games, since research has shown that these games are problematic. Well, you've already mentioned the commercial potential for problems there, so you and he are obviously in sync.
I completely agree with Dr. Kanafani. Twofold. One, because of just the commercialization of media on television and then also in video games. And to move forward as far as on his comment on that, there is definitely good evidence that would suggest that those children engaged in violent gaming have more aggressive behaviors, can lead to secondary behavioral problems. And remember that if you get into prolonged periods of gaming, that can also affect your sleep. And if you have disordered or disruptive sleep, that can lead to consequences later the next day at school. And then that, again, can snowball. So,
you know, we keep hearing, however, that these violent video games may not be having an impact on kids. Maybe that's the industry itself trying to protect itself and perpetuate itself. But is there really solid evidence out there that violent video games do generate violent behavior?
Right. I mean, it's always hard, you know, when a parent is saying, well, my child does this and they don't. They haven't gone out and done some major act of violence. And I think what you really have to look at is from a population standpoint as far as all those kids. And I think also it's hard because are kids that participate in violent video games those that may be more likely to subsequently do those activities? Or are you actually, because of the games, you know, moving into that group? Either way, it definitely would show that more aggressive behaviors result because of that. And that makes sense because, again, they're seeing it. They're interacting with that for prolonged periods of time.
How do you counsel parents with regard to with this?
You know, it's difficult. Again, I think starting with what their perspective is and then also going to what's going to appeal the most to this particular family, be it either the video game side, the commercialization, you know, the amount of advertising for tobacco, alcohol, all these other things that come across. And then not to get away also from the fact that those children who watch a lot of television and then also get in other forms of media get shown a lot of things as far as unhealthy eating habits. And when you talk about a sedentary population that's maybe not exercising and is getting marketed to with unhealthy food products, I mean, that really was where we move into being overweight and obese.
Are you aware of any efforts, significant efforts to have some sort of control over these media messages that are particularly aimed at kids?
You know, it's a great question. Certainly, you know, we're fortunate that tobacco marketing hasn't been on television for a really long time. However, if you look at the alcohol marketing that is on day-to-day on television, particularly for sporting events, you know, there was a study that was very sobering, literally from a perspective that children were more likely to recognize Budweiser frogs as they would certain characters on Sesame Street. And if you think of that, they may not subsequent, you know, market direct to those kids, but they see it and they're in the background for that. And what are the long-term consequences for that?
And this is not lost on the people who market these products. I think of Joe Camel, for instance. Joe Camel has addicted how many millions of young people?
You know, I think it's a great parallel as far as for some of those things. Yeah. And the reality is that a 13 to 17-year-old is soon going to be 21 to 26, you know. And I think that building that subliminal foundation early on. And you're talking about a group, however, that's not developmentally ready for a lot of those things. So they may be watching age-appropriate programming on television, but then the commercials are not subsequently to that. So you really have to sit and watch, you know, interact with your kids while this is ongoing.
And yet, correct me if I'm wrong, it's my impression that parents are not spending as much time with their children today, largely because of all the distractions that they have and the children have as well.
Well, you know, and it's twofold as far as, we come home from work and, you know, maybe we eat dinner and then what do? You know, maybe we sit down in front of a screen or on the computer or something else because it could be the world that the adults are living in also. I think having open conversations, having the television off during dinner time, having these conversations that you and I are talking about is so important. And then talking through and recognizing that there are limits. You know, just like anything, dinner is from here to here. Our screen time could be here to here as a family. Let's talk about this. But then beyond that and enforcing those limits.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that families don't sit down together for dinner as much anymore as they might have just a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, our day-to-day activities are disruptive in and of itself, right. Let alone for a 15, 30, or even an hour-long discussion with a family.
Sure. Let's take some calls, Doctor. Dr. Matt Broom is our guest. We're talking about those screen devices that young people are so into these days. We'll begin with Eric calling from St. Louis. Eric, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm really into this topic. We've grown up, I've raised my children without having TV or internet or video in the home, and the benefits have been great. But I have a specific question, which is, how would you break down the effects of all this screen time on, say, ADHD, and the other possible category, which would be loss of attention, just shortened attention span or increased distractibility? I know those are sort of intertwined, but what does the research show on that?
You know, it's a great question, Eric. Thanks. I mean, you're right. It's hard to specifically break it down because there's so many different factors that come in for an individual family. However, I think that let's say, for instance, where we'll talk about maybe a 10-year-old who has a lot of aggressive video gaming that they're watching, and maybe they're having subsequent behavioral problems at school, and maybe they're getting labeled as being overly active or hyperactive subsequent to that. I think that talking with that family, working with that school, trying to set appropriate limits for that particular child may be very, very helpful. I think that I would be careful to say that always – you know, you watched X hours of television, and that's clearly why you subsequently developed ADHD. I wouldn't go so far as for that because there's so many other – it's not a blood test or something you can diagnose that with. It's a clinical diagnosis. However, there are those influences, and we can't ignore them because we see those patterns, and they're a big part of our lives.
Eric, thank you for the call. Speaking of video games, let's bring Tom from Jennings into the conversation. He wants to talk about that, so go ahead, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The doctor was kind of beating around the bush, so I just want to clear something up. There's absolutely zero correlation between playing violent video games and violent behavior, okay? And if there's any question that this is true, all we have to do is look at the countries that play extremely high rates of these video games, these violent video games, Grand Theft Auto, whatever you can think of, and they have the lowest crime rates. Japan, for example, China has very low crime, relatively speaking. There's no reason to think that these kids are having negative effects from playing these first-person shooters and things if they're old enough to handle them. But anyway, I know of no data, and I just wanted to clear that up because the doctor's not very forthcoming about that.
Tom, are you a gamer?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm an educator, too. And I have kids do things like create video games as a way of learning, you know. And I just hate to stifle their creativity. Of course, we don't want them committing virtual violent crimes all the time. But
Or even part-time.
Yeah. Well, you know, we read books that have crimes in them. We do, you know, crime is part of our entertainment, you know. So it's foolish to think that crime would not also be a subject of video games when it's obviously a subject in every other form of media we have, you know. But anyway, I just wanted to clear that up. There's no negative consequences that have been proven from these games.
Tom, thank you so much for the call. Okay, doctor, the ball is in your court, as they say.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it. Hey, you know, a couple of things to think about as far as for that. One, you're right. I mean, there are violent books and there are violent stories, many of which have been made for adults and not children and not adolescents and certainly not young children. I think that to really answer this question, you have to look at it in the context of all of the factors that are coming in. If you do not feel, or if people do not feel in general, that aggressive behaviors, violent video games, killing, that kind of thing would not have some level of impressionability on a 5 to 10-year-old who may not have otherwise been exposed to these themes, there are actually, through the American Academy of Pediatrics, a couple of policy statements that would disagree with that opinion. Secondarily, I think that it's an important thing to look at. I mean, you mentioned some of these countries as being violent countries that have a lot of gamers and that kind of thing. What we're really looking at is, you know, what are the age of those gamers? Are they adults who can handle that content maturely? Are they young children who then, if they bring some of these violent behaviors to schools and are younger kids, that do they have more bullying secondary to that? Are they learning that bullying from school? And what is the lasting impact on those kids? It is something that can't be ignored. I think that if you encourage that, and the last thing I want to do is to discourage creativity. I think that's something that our kids need and can thrive. And also, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying never play video games. I think that we need to talk about age-appropriate gaming for children because, yes, they grow up with it, but it actually can have consequences in how they interact with other children, and it is a big issue, particularly at schools.
How do you determine what age is appropriate for certain games? Are they included in the games themselves, ideal for 4 to 9-year-olds? Or
right.
Whatever?
I mean, it would be almost akin to, you know, PG-13 versus R. I mean, they are game ratings as far as on that, but the hard part is, and I empathize as far as with the gaming manufacturers from that, they can't predict as far as for what an individual, let's say, in St. Louis is going to be ready for. And I think that's where what we're really looking at is to get some buy-in from parents and to recognize that sometimes their kids may be ready for some material, and if you talk about it, maybe they can handle it, and maybe they can handle themselves at school secondarily to that. But there's other kids who aren't yet ready for it, and that can be a real issue.
There are societal aspects to this as well. And some of the societies that Tom mentioned there, Japan, for instance, access to weapons, guns in particular, is much less than it is in this country. European nations, there are very strict and stringent rules about that kind of weaponry. And that may play a role in the lack of violence as well, I'm guessing here.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I actually had the opportunity to live in Japan for about 3 years, and I agree wholeheartedly. And in a nation without firearms or the, you know, with stringent, you know, laws
rules
against
sure.
against that, it's hard to really look at violent crime the same versus in the United States. And I think that, you know, again, there's a lot of benefits as far as for gaming. But we really can't turn a blind eye as far as to what the implications could be on our kids, particularly from a developmental standpoint for kids.
On the issue of video games, let's bring in Brant calling from St. Louis. He has a point of view he wants to express. So go ahead, Brant.
Yeah, I think maybe you pretty much covered what I was about to say. I totally disagree with the last caller. You can't compare apples to oranges. The United States is not Japan, is not any other country besides here. And that never works with any argument when you're trying to make any kind of argument for a political position of any kind. Also, I want to say something about television. I just bought a TV about 3 years ago. And I have an international satellite dish, and I mainly watch international TV. I get to watch Jewish news. I watch Al Jazeera. I watch Russian news in English. I see all kinds of things that you just don't get from the American media. And I think we have kind of a boring culture, to be frank, and it's very polarized. And I want to make a bumper sticker that says, your life is more interesting than television.
All right, Brant, thanks so much. Feel free. Go ahead and make that bumper sticker. Why not?
Give me an extra one of those, Brant. I'd love that. Yeah, I think the other big issue is that, you know, all of this time that we're doing that, we really can't look away also from the known health issues associated with lots of screen time. You know, so let's say a child spends a lot of time on you know, video games or watching television or movies, or maybe they go on an Olympic marathon for 3 weeks to really do that. But again, they're not getting active. They're not getting out. We have such an issue as far as not only in pediatric and adolescent health, but obviously that leads to adult healthcare outcomes as far as being overweight, being obese. And these are major issues, not only for us here locally, but nationally. And we have to look at how to address each one of those. And it's beyond just diet and exercise. Screen time is first and foremost on that. And it's not because someone drew a line in the sand and said, we think this. There's good evidence that if you don't have a lot of screen time, you are healthier. And that's important, and an important message to look at.
One of the things that popped up in some of my research on this is there are sleep issues associated with screening, if I can call it that. Anxiety is an issue that often is associated with it. Those, and are there others that you could point to?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing as far as with sleep, you see, you talk about developing the right place to sleep and getting ready for sleep. But if you have a television screen that's on and there's background noise and maybe you want to, you know, your parents close the door and then you get onto the internet, you get somewhere maybe you shouldn't be, you know, you can be up later before you know it's 1 or 2 in the morning and now you've got school at 8 o'clock in the morning or, you know, 8:30 in the morning. And then you had a test that day and how can you prepare? And I think as parents, you know, it's important to remember that our job is to be parents first and friends second, right? Like our job is to guide our children through childhood and to set them up for the best success, be it either creativity as maybe an online gamer, which would be great. But at the same time, you know, we want to get them there with the right tools. So,
are you recommending that you take the television set out of the child's room, period?
I do, yeah. I mean, and that's not, again, that's not a Dr. Broom alone recommendation.
Sure.
That's kind of a universal recommendation to, again, with those two questions, how many hours a day do your children spend with a screen? And with the goal being less than 2, and then do they have a television screen in their room or an internet-connected device or the ability to connect to the internet?
We have to take another break. We have more calls. I'll get to those as soon as we come back. We're talking with Dr. Matt Broom, a pediatrician at Slu Care and Cardinal Glennon, and our question is dealing with screen time. If you have screen time, that is. If you have questions or comments on this issue that you'd like to raise, give us a call at 382-8255 or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL On Air. Back with Dr. Broom in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Dr. Matt Broom about the screen time that young people, the amount of time that young people spend in front of a screen. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment and take your phone calls as well. But here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom are following today. Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro says Normandy schools in St. Louis County will remain open at least through the end of the current school year. Nicastro said in a letter today to parents and students that education officials will work with Normandy's administration to make sure that the school year is completed with minimal disruption. The St. Louis Public School District is working toward or has already put in place a string of recommendations that were laid out in a state audit issued in September. That's the takeaway from a follow-up report released this morning from the Missouri Auditor's Office. And Missouri senators have passed legislation that would send federal agents to jail for enforcing some federal gun laws. The Senate voted today to send the measure to the House. It would declare any federal law considered by the state to infringe on gun rights to be null and void in Missouri. However, courts have consistently ruled that states cannot nullify federal laws. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation on screen time for young people with Dr. Matt Broom, pediatrician at Slu Care and Cardinal Glennon. We seem to have touched a button with regard to the video games issue, Doctor. So let's go back to the phones. A couple of folks want to weigh in on that. And we will begin with Ed calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I listen to your show all the time, and I've never been so disgusted with a caller as that guy. And I want to just relate that I was listening to this station today, and I heard on radio what happened in Springfield, and they described it, and I had to turn it off. Do you see? Because I could visualize that. And I'm just saying, I could visualize that, and I had to turn it off. Do you see? Because those ideas are going through my head, and I visualize that. And finally, I want to say, I am so disgusted with this station because I don't want to hear. You haven't said it, Mr. Marsh, but I hear Pussy Riot way too often. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Any comment, Doctor? I mean, we're getting a there's a thread that's developing here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the biggest thing is that, again, I mean, there wouldn't be such an emphasis on limiting violent video games for young children and impressionable teenagers if there wasn't some evidence behind that. And I think that's the big message. And I, you know, we are blessed to be in a country where as parents we can make those decisions on what our children do or don't do as far as what they can see in screen time. But at the same time, my job is really to kind of put out and say, hey, there are some risks associated with that, and let's talk about it, because we all do want our kids to do really well, not only socially. We want them to do well in school. We want them to do well beyond school once they get out of our house someday. And I think that we want to, you know, help people set themselves up for success. I think right. That's the big message.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out, too, that with regard to this this band, this female band in Russia, Pussy Riot, it's getting an awful lot of publicity recently because of the activities that these young ladies have been engaged in anti-government activities, if you will, costing a couple of them a few years in jail. And they're all over the news. It's very, very hard to avoid that.
Yeah, it sounded like they were looking for an, you know, a YouTube-like video that they can go, and now I'm sure they have it, and sure. It's going to get played. And I think, if anything, it just plays to something like that speaks to the marketing and the ability for something to just spread like wildfire. And I think that's the big message as far as for parents. I mean, if you think of who's watching that, it's our teens. You know, that's the group that sees that, and being able to set boundaries and limits and use it as an opportunity to talk about is this appropriate, is this not appropriate, what do we think about this, that creates a great, you know, discussion point for teenagers.
And also, with regard to the last call during the break, producer Alex Hoyer brought me he's done some research in the past on the issue of violence in video games, and this is what he put in my hands. There's been a lot of research that's been conducted into whether violent video games leads to violent behavior, and certainly is contentious. Douglas Gentile, a psychologist at Iowa State University, is an expert in this field of video game research, and he says that research shows that children who play more violent games by and large behave more aggressively. But, he adds, that doesn't necessarily mean that it leads to school shootings. One big note about that research is that the sample size is just so small, and there are certainly other factors as to why children behave aggressively, many of which you have already alluded to. Now, I'm going to bring in another influence, perhaps, on violent behavior from Karen, who is calling from Quincy Hannibal. Karen, go ahead with your thoughts. Karen, are you there? We'll try it one more time. Well, I have the gist of what Karen might have said if we had been able to make contact here, and she says that Grimm's fairy tales for kids are a good example of violence. Every one of them, it would seem to me, as I remember them, had some sort of a bloody outcome or violent outcome.
Absolutely. And if you look at so many children's books, I mean, maybe what we've all been read to before or not, I mean, there's some that you pull it down and you're like, oh, I read this, you know, I had this as a child, I'll read it to my kids. You start going through and you're like, whoa, hold on, do I want to be going through this? But I think the key on that is you're reading to your child. You recognize it. You talk about it with them. What do you think about this? Is this right? Is this not right? Versus if they see it on television and you're not with them, it's all on their own impression, you know, how they perceive it, what comes in, what is or isn't right. And I think, again, getting back to the media influence, I mean, there's so much evidence of violence on television constantly, and there's evidence of substance abuse, be it either alcohol, et cetera. I think there was one estimate where, you know, every 20 minutes on television you see some type of use of alcohol. It's probably even more for cigarettes and that kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. Again, it's what our kids are seeing. So there are opportunities for discussion, which is important.
Well, let's bring in Phil calling from Baldwin. He's going to look at this from a somewhat different angle, I believe. Go ahead, Phil. You're on the air.
Okay, let's go back to the late 60s or 70s. Music inspired Charles Manson to commit horrible murders. And he was trying to start a race war because of Beatles songs. I mean, we don't need more evidence. When you have children and things bad happen to them, they bring school counselors into the school. But back in my day, my mom and dad sat down with me and taught me not to hate anybody.
Now, Phil, when you say we don't need more evidence and you cite the Beatles music, Helter Skelter, what are you saying there? I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, violence begets violence. There's rock and roll music and that led the people to commit diabolical devil worshiping murders, human sacrifices. We got the rap music. Luckily, you know, some people are trying to nip it in the bud, but the rap music is inciting other groups of people to violence. It's not just videos.
Okay, that's where I wanted to take you on that, to clarify your comment. Phil, thanks for your comment. Well, he's right, of course. There are so many impulses that we receive every day from so many different sources.
Absolutely. And when you're talking about hundreds of million people, I mean, everyone acting so differently, how someone might perceive a program or how they act on it or all the influences in their life that have set them up leading to that point, you know, no one can predict those things. I think that the biggest message is, again, talking to families about, you know, what are the benefits of media, developing a media use plan for your family, and then what are the potential risks if you don't do that?
You know, it's interesting that the tone and the avenues that this program has taken. We've been talking about screen time for young people, and almost all of the focus from our listeners has been on the video games and the issue and the controversy over violence. Let's bring in Zach now, calling from Washington, Missouri. Go ahead, Zach. You're on the air.
Hey, Don. Great topic. It's something me and my wife have been kind of concerned in talking about ourselves. We have a 13-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a newborn baby boy.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk about some of the benefits of the recent technologies, like some of the online services like Netflix and Hulu, as far as avoiding commercials, because it's all commercial-free for the most part. There was that, and then also the benefits of like some of the video game services as far as not being sedentary. Like almost all of the major game consoles now have some sort of like, active controllers and stuff where you're up and moving around. So that's another benefit of some, recent technologies and stuff. So I think things can trend in the right way, but it's definitely something concerning as far as limiting, just screen time in general. I think we're a little bit over the 2-hour mark, but so we got a little work to do. That's my comment.
Thanks for your call. Doctor?
Yeah, boy, you're certainly not alone, and it sounds like you're doing a really great job. And you bring up some excellent points. I agree. If you can eliminate some of that outside commercialization as far as through some of those services, you know, maybe it is worthwhile as parents to pay for some of that so you don't have to, have all those additional influences. I still think it's important to have limits, which it certainly sounds like what you're doing. And you also bring up a great point that's part and parcel with, yes, we're doing screen time, but as a nation, we hear this to get more and more active. And some of those gaming systems allow for that. And the other thing, you've got a 13-year-old. Wow, if this is a way you can connect with them while you're being active and do it together, what a great opportunity as far as for that to increase fitness. And maybe that will build into doing more things together. And I think the other big issue is, households are like yours where it's, you've got a new baby, you've got a teenager, you've got lots of different things. You really do have to have different levels of, okay, well, on this device, I have this level of restriction. On this device, I don't. So it's not a perfect fix for everybody, but you're doing a great job.
Yeah, the problem there is the fact that you've got kids of separate ages and different levels of interests and what have you. One sees the other playing something or doing something that they're not allowed to do or shouldn't do. It's a real problem to police that.
Boy, I tell you what, and the biggest thing then again comes for all of us as parents to lay out those expectations. Hey, I know in advance you probably want to do a lot of this, but this is what I expect from you and this is it. And being very frank and keeping those boundaries and allowing people to move within that.
Here's a very interesting observation, an email from Leah. She writes, I am a homeschool mom to 2 boys, ages 4 and 6. Good luck, Leah, with that, just for starters. And while we do watch TV and play games, I find that letting my kids get bored and find ways to play is so valuable. Can you comment on the importance of play and boredom for kids?
Oh, I think it's a great comment from Leah, and I really appreciate it. I mean, boredom breeds creativity, and I love it when our kids come and say, well, I can't find anything to do. And as soon as they say that, they can see in my eyes that I will find them something for them to do. In the same way, as far as with kids, they start really pushing themselves. And if they're in front of a screen, they don't have to do that. It's plug and play, pre-programmed right there. But the ability to go out and do that and to think about, well, I've done this puzzle before. Can I do it quicker? Can I do it in a different way? Can I build something? Can I draw something? You know, what a great way for kids to really push their minds in a different avenue or a different way that maybe they haven't explored before. And I think that's the real message of what we get at, not only for those kids less than two, but maybe 2 to 5 before they get into school, because we want that level of creativity. We don't want kids to shut that down. So I completely agree.
You know, we don't want to return to the thrilling days of 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but those were times when kids invented games. We hear an expression all the time on the radio and television now about, in regard to politics, about kicking the can down the road. Well, I'm old enough to remember when that was a game that we played, because the only thing we had to play with was a Campbell's soup can, and that's what kids did.
You know what? But at the same time, you're outside, you're moving, you're being interactive. You probably found a lot of different ways to play kick the can as far as with your friends. And it's the same thing as far as for our kids. You know, that yes, there's online games and there's video games, but there's also board games. Yeah. And they can really push the mind. They can get kids out of their box. They can learn problem solving. And those things are really, really important. There's some great board games that you can work with. And let's not forget about music, too. Kids can learn a lot from that. And maybe they can listen to music with parents and have another opportunity to talk about things.
And the good news is you can play those board games now on an iPad.
Or that's right. Yeah, you're right.
Telephone.
Exactly.
All right, let's take another call. Mike and Webster Groves, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hey, Don, I'm an old guy, too. I'm 67, and when I was a kid, after school I had two choices, watch Woody Woodpecker or play baseball. Now kids are overwhelmed with decisions to make, and they're going to have to make them, as are we as adults. I mean, I embrace all this technology. I'm a big fan of it. But the simple thing is, we can't escape this technology. Best embrace it for its values. And always, like your guest is saying, the main thing is be there with your kids. Teach them your values, and they'll make the right choices.
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's one of those things that, you know, we can all reflect on, would you rather spend more time at work or more time with your children when they're growing up? And I think that lasting influence on kids is so important in being able to kind of work through different things with them. And we can't put our kids in a bubble. I mean, they're going to get to this technology. They get to it at school. They get to it at practice for activities. I mean, other kids have it. So by proactively addressing it with them, you know, it can be fun. And you can get in and do neat things. And, you know, it's going to keep, you know, developing. I mean, I'm excited to know what happens in 5 and 10 years.
Yeah, we have to reinforce the point that we're not saying it's all bad, but that it does have to be policed to some degree so that it can be taken full advantage of and not cause some bad habits or whatever. You just raised an issue that I think we should discuss in the time that remains, and that is the peer pressure that comes into play here, because it is a factor. Parents are one thing, and the parents can certainly do that policing I mentioned, but the kids spend a lot more time with their peers.
They really do. And you know what? It's, Johnny has this, so I want it too. Or they have this game, well, I want it too. Well, I have this free app, but if you spend this money, I can get the full app. I mean, we hear all that all of the time. And I think, again, it comes back to setting limits and saying, well, I understand they have this, but this is what we're going to do instead. And, you know, you might get that look from your kids like they're frustrated and they're not happy about it. But the reality is, you know, again, you're making decisions that are best decisions for them down the line. And I think you talk about it just as if somebody has a better baseball glove or a better book or a newer car or something. And again, great opportunities to talk about what, you know, limits are.
We only have 1 minute left, and you bring to mind something else that I had always heard, and that is that kids really like rules. They like knowing what the parameters are.
Well, those kids that are given rules, it's easier as far as for them to get into a routine and to get into scheduling. And I think all of us as parents who know that kids tend to thrive with consistency and, you know, minimizing changes in schedules, by setting that up and setting those clear expectations, it makes it a lot easier to flow. That doesn't mean there's not speed bumps along the way in any house. No one's clearly perfect for anything. However, rules and structure can really be beneficial for kids succeeding academically.
In the few seconds that remain, what would you want the takeaway? I'm sure most of the listeners today are parents rather than the kids because of school. What would you want the takeaway to be for those parents?
So I would say, you know, considering how many hours of screen time not related to school, non-educational screen time, do kids do? Do they have a television in their room? And what is their media plan at home? And thinking about it as a family and then moving that into action with your own children.
Dr. Matt Broom, thanks so much for being with us. This has been a most informative hour. I'm appreciative of your time.
Thank you. Had a lot of fun.
Matt Broom, pediatrician at SLU Care and Cardinal Glennon. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with UMSL professor Dan Younger about his exhibition at the Sheldon. It's a photographs he took in U.S. tourist spots during breaks and teaching. Also in the next in our soundbite series produced with Sauce Magazine, he talks about community-supported agriculture and Field Foods, the new grocery store in Lafayette Square. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with the author of a new book about the rise of China and how competition between China and the U.S. will dominate 21st century world affairs. Archive version of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Hunningford, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.